The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Charlie Dan, how complicated is this? You've got a triple whammy now, potentially, between, you know, the Middle East, the port strike, controversy over FEMA, and what's happening in, you know, battleground North Carolina and Georgia.
Well, I think it's a very difficult time for the Biden administration and Kamala Harris. They are very beholden to organized labor. I mean, they're, you know, by siding with the Longshoremen's Union, if that's what they're going to do, this could lead to a real disruption in the supply chain, which could create higher demand, obviously, and increased prices. They've also just come out against the Nippon-U.S. steel deal because of the USW opposition, which is a perfectly good deal for making steel in America, frankly. But they're doing it to pander to the union. I would also say that, if Israel strikes Iranian oil infrastructure, that could surge prices. So it's a delicate time. The jury's still out on the response to the hurricane. I think the administration is doing its best, but we'll see how that plays out. We just don't know at this moment.
It's the triple whammy, as Andrea Mitchell said there. You've got flooding in the southeast, dramatic flooding. You've got war in the Middle East, and then this massive port strike on the Gulf and East Coast of the United States. And who's running the country through all of this? Joe Biden is nowhere to be seen. They paraded Kamala Harris out there a little while ago to make her look presidential. She comes out for a 2-minute statement, won't take any questions, just goes right back into hiding. The world is in the midst of some incredible disasters. Donald Trump, he visited Georgia. He donated millions of dollars to the relief fund there. He shamed Joe Biden into finally coming out and making a statement. But here, like Mitchell said there, three really big problems that come up right in the month of October for Kamala Harris, the triple whammy. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. I'm Sam Livingston, your guest host for today's show. We're recording this a day in advance. Today is the Feast of Trumpets, so our offices are closed. We'll talk a little bit more about the meaning of that day later on in the show. But if there's any breaking news, please forgive me. There's bound to be breaking news with how fast events are moving right now in the world. But I tried to make this as current as possible for the news cycle that was going on Wednesday afternoon. So look at the response to this triple whammy of disasters. And you take the track record of the last 4 years, and like we've noted on this show, time after time, you look at their response to these crises and you think, surely there can't be that incompetent. And we've made that point. It's on the cover of the Trumpet magazine here. Chaos by design. This is not incompetence. It's treason, as Mr. Gerald Fleurieu has said. This clip, this was on Fox News. They were in a diner in Michigan. And notice what this citizen said, this resident of Michigan said, and you'll hear this quote, and you have to wonder, is she reading our literature? This is clip 5.
I'm just appalled. I can't believe this is the country I've lived in for 65 years. What's happening has to be intentional. There's no other way to explain what's going on. When I see the thousands upon thousands of military age men coming alone without families, there's reasons for red flags. So yes, the immigration issue is huge.
It has to be intentional. She's just a regular American going out for a meal, and she's got more sense than those two moderators at the vice presidential debate the other night. Just watching the bits of that I did watch, it was insulting how arrogant they were. And they have to know what they're doing, but the way they would just shut down J.D. Vance, I can't remember the exact number of times that they pressed him, I think it was like 12 or 14 times, on questions, then they wouldn't press Tim Walz. And then they would set up every question to J.D. Vance basically with Walz's defense baked into it. So arrogant and talking down to American citizens. And there's one. There's one who gets it. There's one who says, this is so bad, it's hard to believe. It's just incompetence. It has to be intentional. Look at the response to the devastating floods in North Carolina. I mean, these towns just completely wiped out. This was a quote from Mayorkas. He's talking about FEMA. And he says in this quote that FEMA is basically out of money. I'll just read this to you. He says, we are meeting the immediate needs with the money that we have. We are expecting another hurricane hitting. We do not have the funds. FEMA does not have the funds to make it through the season. That's quoting Alejandro Mayorkas. So it's incredible to see how fast Congress can convene and get money together for whatever pet project it is, whatever crisis they decide is important to line their own pockets. They can really convene fast to find money. But when it's American people suffering, I look at that and I think, well, where are even the Republicans in Congress to just say, let's get together and find some more money for them to help them out? There are these stories. I haven't looked into this in a ton of detail, but a lot of these towns are totally shut off. The roads are completely washed away, and rescuers can't get into these towns. So there are a lot of citizens who are offering to help out. You've probably heard of the Cajun Army. And there are these ordinary citizens who have helicopters and they're trying to fly them into these areas. They have drones. They're trying to use them to survey areas to help look for people who are stranded because there's also no internet. And one of these helicopter pilots says that they threatened to arrest him if he flew into these areas. And there was another clip of a drone pilot who said the same thing. You're not allowed to go in there. And I'm sure they have restrictions because the emergency crews want to get in there. But at the moment, that isn't happening in a lot of places. This is a massive problem. There's the story that Elon Musk was talking about. A huge problem there is that people just don't have access to internet. The phones are down. They can't communicate. They can't let anybody know that they're trapped. Elon Musk said, had the FCC not illegally revoked the SpaceX Starlink award, it would probably have saved lives in North Carolina. Lawfare costs lives. Now, basically what he's talking about there is 2 years ago, Joe Biden decided to go to war with Elon Musk. And they had this federal grant that approved for all of these Starlink satellite internet satellites to go into these states. And then the FCC decided that it wanted to investigate the company and revoked all of these licenses so they couldn't operate the Starlink satellite dishes here. And Musk is saying, imagine if all of these people would have had access to something like that, access to satellite internet in these remote areas. How many more lives would have been saved? This is a quote from The Federalist. It says, the FCC's political attack on Elon Musk has put American lives in danger. In 2020, the Federal Communications Commission awarded Musk Starlink an $885 million award to help get broadband access to 642,000 rural homes and businesses in 35 states. A subsidiary of SpaceX, Starlink is a satellite internet system delivering high-speed internet to anyone on the planet. The plan would work out to less than $1,400 per link up, same day delivery on the necessary hardware, and only a few hours to get up and running. Some 20,000 households and businesses in North Carolina would have had access to Starlink if they desired. Of the 21 worst hit counties in North Carolina, the FCC funded Starlink program would have served all or part of 17 of them, according to multiple officials. The FCC suddenly canceled that grant in 2022, a few months before Joe Biden suggested that the federal government find ways to go after Elon Musk. So they don't want the private citizens going in there with their helicopters to help people. They don't want the private citizens using drones to go in there and help people. They don't want Elon Musk's company trying to help people. They want everyone to be totally reliant on the federal government, which is a terrifying prospect when you consider that they hate the American people. When you consider what that woman in Michigan was saying, that this is intentional, that they are attacking American citizens. Jesse Waters said that on that clip Mr. Fleury played. What happened to Maui and East Palestine? The people in these disaster zones in North Carolina and Eastern Tennessee. I mean, the response is so bad, it can't be incompetence. It's intentional. You look at that crisis, then you look at the war in Israel, the massive escalation of Iran launching those ballistic missiles. I mean, imagine if Iron Dome wasn't there. They say, well, it was just symbolic. We had to retaliate. Imagine launching 200 of those at densely populated cities. I mean, that's an attack that could have killed thousands and thousands of people. And the West, Joe Biden's response to Israel is de-escalate, tone it down. We don't want to do anything to provoke a war. So Israel's supposed to just keep getting hit and hit. And a lot of these commentators make that point. Well, Israel's not going into Egypt. They're not bombing Egypt. They're not bombing Saudi Arabia. They're attacking the nations that are attacking Israel. Joe Biden was asked, it sounds like Israel is getting ready to respond to Iran in a pretty heavy-handed way, going after either some ports, which would be, again, this would have another huge impact on economics because of how much oil Iran exports, probably to mostly Asia and Russia. And that's another point with that North Carolina story that a few have touched on, is that that's a big mining region as well for components that go into car manufacturing, especially silicon chips. So if you can't access a lot of these areas, we'll expect the cost of those chips to again rise. Just another thing that's or another challenge for this so-called Biden administration. And now you've got this war in Iran and their ports potentially being blown up. And it sounds like they want to even go after the nuclear facilities. Netanyahu's got to ride this momentum while he can, do it before the election. And this, when Biden was asked, do you support Israel's strikes on the nuclear facilities? Just notice what he said. This clip is a little difficult to hear. This is clip two.
Sir, can I ask you, what is your support on the Takwa Iran nuclear project?
The answer is no.
Just a flat out no. They should not do that. This is an administration that wants Iran to have nuclear weapons. Obama, I can't even distinguish the two of them. I just say Joe Obama all the time. Obama wanted Iran to have this because he hates Israel and America. They did everything they could to support the Iranian state. And Joe Biden's not going to buck up against that. Ben Rhodes and Jake Sullivan, they were the architects of the Iran deal. And they set up all of these sanctions to basically those sunset clauses to expire. And then Donald Trump gets in office and he says there's an arms embargo. Iran cannot import any sort of ballistic missiles. And that's just what you'd think is common sense. As soon as Biden got in there, they backtracked Trump's decision, made it go back to the JCPOA and said, actually, we're back to the original plan, and that arms embargo does now expire. Iran is free to import ballistic missiles. For their own security, I guess. Right? That's what they say. Iran can pursue nuclear development because they have a right to. They just want to produce nuclear energy for themselves. That clip that Mr. Fleury played of Karine Jean-Pierre saying, if anything, we've been harder on Iran. We haven't lifted any sanctions. And the reporter just flat out says, well, they're exporting more oil than they ever have. They're bringing in $100 billion annually from oil exports. And again, just lying straight to your face. We didn't lift any sanctions. And they just have this cute way of getting around saying or talking around what they're actually doing. Well, we just went right back to the JCPOA. We didn't actually do that. It was we're just going right back to the plan that we all agreed on. So you've got that crisis in North Carolina. You've got this crisis in the Middle East. And then you've got these port strikes on the East Coast and on the Gulf. And this is a bigger deal. I think this is going to start affecting even other countries. I think primarily the United States imports most of its goods are coming from China and the East. So they're coming from the West Coast, and all of those ports are still open. But a lot of what we export is going out through the Gulf and out through the East Coast. A lot of food, grain coming down through the Mississippi River there, and then a lot of the manufacturing in the East is being exported there. And now there's going to be this huge holdup of these goods not being able to get out and get to their destinations. They're estimating that that crisis will cost them $5 billion per day. Will cost the United States $5 billion a day. Will cost you $5 billion a day. Not you personally, literally paying $5 billion, but your products are going to increase in price again. And Kamala, they're firmly behind the union workers. You look at the demands of these unions, and this isn't like a union strike, you know, 120 years ago with the coal workers, where they were really genuinely being abused. These guys have pretty good incomes, and the union boss, I think his annual salary is something like 900 grand a year. He lives in a big mansion. They want something like a 70 to 75% pay increase, and then they want these guarantees that their jobs won't be lost to automation, as has happened in every other industry. So this could go on for a long time, because, well, how long are these workers going to hold out? How long are they going to go without pay? How long will these port authorities put up with this? And it's in many ways an impossible situation. But Kamala is firmly behind the union workers. She needs their support. All of this happening right before the big election. Joe Biden, he's missing. The fake president is missing. The fake vice president, she's running, you could call it a sitcom presidency. She gets out there and tries to act presidential. And then Obama's just behind the scenes, laughing, enjoying all of it, watching the United States get decimated. This is a tweet from Charlie Kirk. He writes, "Chaos is everywhere. There's just been a mass shooting in Tel Aviv, Israel, and what appears to be a horrific terror attack. Iran has just launched a ballistic missile attack against Israel. Half the ports in the country are closed, and a longshoreman strike costing America billions every day. North Carolina is still underwater with a death toll over 130, and hundreds more still missing. October is full of surprises, and it's just day one." We heard a message recently from Mr. Ryan Malone, and he asked, where are we going to be in 5 weeks? That is not a long time. Where are we going to be on November 6th? How much more affliction is there going to be? This article, just writing along that same theme of what that woman in Michigan said. That's like the theme for a lot of our shows, what she said. It doesn't seem like this is on accident. What's happening has to be intentional, she said. This article is in Fox News. DOJ sues Alabama, state's top election official, for allegedly purging non-citizen voters too close to election. How do you explain this one? Alabama is trying to clean up its voter rolls, and there are non-citizens in the state who are given these ID numbers so that they can work, but they're not allowed to vote. So Alabama's going through and getting them off of the voter rolls, but there's this rule that says, well, you're not allowed to purge your voter rolls within like 60 days of an election, which is just absolute nonsense. So the federal government is suing the state of Alabama for doing this. I don't know what the recourse would be. Let's assume the DOJ wins this case. Okay, the 3,500 non-citizens get to be back on the voter rolls. So does that mean you want them to go illegally vote? There's no way to argue this unless you want fake ballots, unless you want non-citizens to be able to vote. And of all the crazy things going on in this country at this moment, this is what Biden's federal government decides to argue, decides to spend your money on. Fox News says the DOJ sued the state of Alabama and its top election official, alleging that they had removed voters who had previously been issued non-citizen identification numbers from its election rolls too close to election day. Non-citizen identification numbers are a tax processing number issued by the IRS to ensure that people, including undocumented immigrants, pay taxes. Along with paying taxes, non-citizen identification numbers can provide legal migrants with securing a driver's license and providing proof of residency. After being sworn into office in January, Alabama Secretary of State Wes Allen got to work to identify and remove 3,251 individuals who are registered to vote in Alabama who have been issued non-citizen identification numbers by the Department of Homeland Security. Why would the DOJ go and do this? Why would they? And on top of that, how does this not get thrown out for lack of standing? On whose behalf are they making this case? Did they go and find these non-citizens and actually say, we're bringing this case on your behalf. We are fighting for you because we want you to be on the voter rolls, even though you can't vote. This is ludicrous, and it reminds me of the vice presidential debate just two nights ago, and J.D. Vance is asked about January 6th, and Margaret loaded up that question for him. This case was election fraud was tried in 68 courts. It was adjudicated, and every judge, based on the evidence, decided there was no fraud. I wish J.D. Vance, he's trying to be very tactful. I guess I get it from that point of view. But where's the masculinity to just raise your voice a little bit at Margaret and say, you are lying. It was not adjudicated 68 times. We didn't get a chance to present our evidence. And you know why it's such a genius scheme? Because that's impossible to do between election day and the day you certify. You try to bring in a case, a legal case, that big, that exhaustive, that massive. You try to do that in 5 weeks. We couldn't get a judge to delay anything so that we could actually present the evidence. And they just said, lack of standing, lack of standing, lack of standing. And then the day we are going to present the evidence to the American people, January 6th, that's what that day was for, you wouldn't let us do it. I don't even remember what he said, but it wasn't that impactful. And they try to weasel around it because they don't want, the writing was bad. Sure, it was bad, but this was not an insurrection. And boy, the Democrats they worship January 6th. And he couldn't just have a bit of a stronger stance on that to put those people in their place. Fact check the moderator. Then you look at a story like what they're doing in Alabama, and the question is about upholding democracy. And he can't say, let's just look at the last 4 years. Let's just look who is pro-democracy. To his credit, he did say, how is this an insurrection when on January 20th, the day that we're supposed to have the peaceful transfer of power, Donald Trump just walked out? January 6th is not the day that we expect the peaceful transfer of power. It's the day that is formalized for the U.S. citizenry. If they want election fraud exposed, that's really the only day that it can happen because the courts aren't going to let it happen. So that's the day. Why else have this day where it gets certified, where you go through every single state, where you have the electors counted? What's the point of having all of these electors? What's the point of having the state legislators? If when there is fraud, we don't get to hear about it. That's what J.D. Vance should have said. There's no way to investigate election fraud in this country. That's an attack on democracy. Anyway, going back to the debate, this, I think there are a lot of Democrats admitted, you know, Tim Walz lost that. But there are the hardliners, and Joe Scarborough, he says he's a Republican. Listen to his defense of Tim Walz's performance at the debate. Clip one.
There's no doubt that despite the fact, if you look at the numbers, Walz won this debate. She said the thing that elites make the most fun of, that the fact that Bush talks like a regular guy, that Bush is smooth, is not a smooth talker, his syntax is a little off. Said what the elites
right
at the New York Times and the Washington Post don't understand is that's why regular guys like Bush so much. Biden. And you can say the same thing about Joe Biden. But you look at the favorable unfavorables after the debate and you just kind of wonder if they're looking at the Ivy League guy and seeing what a smooth talker he was. And then the regular guy. Who again stumbled around a little bit, was nervous, but they're thinking, yeah, who wouldn't be nervous? And maybe that's why his favorabilities went up so much. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like when you and I talk, you're an Ivy League guy, very smooth.
Erudite.
I'm a country lawyer.
So Walz won. He's just a normal guy. Remember how much people liked Bush? Remember how much they made fun of Bush? Actually, I think Joe Scarborough was a Republican when Bush was elected. Anyway, remember how much they hated Bush, how much they would laugh at the way he talked? Well, now Tim Walz, that's the way Americans talk. If it's Donald Trump, though, and he messes or stumbles a word, or he makes a funny joke, that's so uncivil. That's not presidential. They have to play it both ways, right? And then now it's rich to hear them say, J.D. Vance, ooh, the Ivy League, ooh, slimeball, he's a smooth talker. I bet every one of them has an Ivy League degree on these shows. That's the label. They go there and they get the piece of paper and they can wave it around and say, I went to Yale, I went to Harvard. And now when they get a taste of their own medicine, and really, J.D. Vance did it in the way that it should be done. It was very logical. They can't stand that because he's playing their game. And then you want to talk about civility. There were moments during that debate that were a bit frustrating just hearing them kind of like grovel for each other. I agree with you. We have a lot more in common. They're debating with people. Tim Walz signed a bill that basically said, if there's a botched abortion and that baby's born alive, the doctor has to leave the baby on that table to die. Now, you have to have civility, but that's not somebody that you should really want to be chummy with and be friendly with. How do you find common ground with people like that? But the Democrats now, they were talking about, we've got to have civility, 4 years. Trump is so uncivil, we have to have a return to civility. And then Tim Walz, listen to this response. This was on CBS talking about, well, Tim Walz, he was just too nice. Clip four.
I think the civility that we saw tonight may be a mistake by Democrats, quite frankly. I talked at the outset of energizing this base. I was just in Ohio, and many Democrats were livid about what's going on in Springfield. I think Walz missed an opportunity to really push the racial insensitivity there. There was a sense of trying to be affable, as John said. And I think what we're going to see from this point on is the civility being laid aside. And as we've said, from this point on, gloves are off, I think.
That's pretty heated rhetoric. The gloves are off. That sounds like violent rhetoric. But they're upset that Tim Walz wasn't more uncivil. You can't win with them. It's like what Mr. Fleury was talking about in the Life and Teachings of Christ class. John the Baptist lives this way, and they pick on him for that way. And Christ does the opposite, and they pick on him for that. You can't win. this article was just hilarious, listening to them try to diagnose the debate performance and read into the body language of each of the candidates there. This was in Politico. It was titled, Eight Body Language Tells from the Vice Presidential Debate. They have a whole paragraph explaining how J.D. Vance's beard is too masculine, and that could really play a role in pushing undecided women voters. Whatever. The funnier one to me was when they tried to explain why Tim Walz looked like a deer in the headlights almost every time he was talking or a question was asked to him. We need to play some sad or funny music behind this. This was Politico. When Walz felt especially passionate about something, he'd open his eyes wide as saucers. Eye-popping can sometimes be a sign of surprise, but for Walz, it simply revealed his emotional intensity, like this moment during an exchange about abortion. I don't even know how to pronounce this stuff. The orbicularis oculi muscle, working in concert with the corrugator and frontalis muscles, contract to raise the eyebrows, a dynamic and emphatic facial motion that grabbed the viewer's attention. It grabbed my attention because I thought it was hilarious. Early humans would have made such facial gestures to communicate strong emotions like danger is close. For Walz, it gave extra weight to his feelings and held our gaze. Yes, it held my gaze. I could not stop laughing. Because even when J.D. Vance was saying something or he was disowning Kamala Harris, Tim Walz is over on the side like nodding his head with his eyes wide open. That you cannot salvage the regime media. They are beyond repair. So just enjoy it. We could play the Oprah clip. The what? Anyway, I had a couple articles here talking about masculinity. I thought maybe I could use the beard comment to shift into a few of these articles that have come up recently about the decline of men in our society. This is a clip. This was from Doug Emhoff. I don't even remember what you would call him right now. He would be the second gentleman, whatever. It's Kamala Harris's husband. He is on with the Circleback girl, Saki. And just listen to some of the details of this clip. This is clip 6.
There's also been an important part or an interesting part of how people have talked about your role here is how your role has reshaped the perception of masculinity. And I'm not sure you planned on that, but you are an incredibly supportive spouse. Has that been an evolution for you? And do you think that's part of the role you might play as first gentleman?
It's funny. I've started to think a lot about this. I've always been like this. My dad was like this. And to me, it's the right thing to do, you know, support women. It's mutual, like with Kamala and I, we support each other, we have each other's back. And I've said many times when we lift up women, we support women, whether it's pay equity, childcare, family leave, and all these issues that, and, you know, this post-Dobbs hellscape, women should not be less than. Women should not have less rights and be treated differently. That's not the American way. And it's also not like, if some woman succeeds, some dude out there is suffering. It's not a one-to-one relationship. When we lift up women, we lift up families, we lift up the economy. And when I was in the business world, it lifted up the organizations that I was in. It certainly lifted up the White House. When you were there with you there and Kamala as vice president, it was a great workplace there.
There's a pop culture phrase, wife guy, which you've kind of been known as. Are you familiar with this?
I've heard about it.
As called a wife guy, a proud wife guy? How do you feel about that?
Well, if I do something annoying to Kamala and she gets upset, I'll just show her that article. Right. I'll say, I'm right. Trying.
I'll be honest, I didn't spend a lot of time researching that clip. I'm not familiar with that term. It sounds like he's just some sort of pushover being a wife guy. There are lots of articles about Doug Emhoff now and Tim Walz and this, the resurgence or renaissance of masculinity, as if they're what is going to appeal to the undecided male voter. Just for context, Doug Emhoff, he cheated on his wife, got the nanny pregnant. It's not clear yet whether or not it was a miscarriage or he forced her to get an abortion. And then there's an article yesterday about how he abused his girlfriend. I think that was even after the affair. So it's to hear these people go on about Trump having no moral compass. There was a clip, I just saw it resurface a couple days ago about, you know, it was breaking news when it happened in the early or mid-2000s. Gavin Newsom, he cheated. I think it was someone that worked for him. And he had an affair with that man's wife. And then suddenly when it comes to Donald Trump, they've got this moral backbone. Refer back to that Joe Scarborough clip where he's talking about how, well, it's just more relatable to hear them fumble around. It wasn't just that Tim Walz fumbled around. It's that he was trying to fumble around lies. He told lies and he was trying to talk his way out of it and he couldn't do it. He couldn't even, well, I don't even want to say that that's a good thing, but he couldn't lie in an eloquent way. They don't know how to speak. This is a leadership crisis in our country. Now, I'm not saying that you should lie and just try to be as sophisticated about it as you can. But Scarborough's clip there, I mean, the gaffes that Tim Walz had were because he was caught lying and he was fumbling around trying to get out of it. And he had quite a few other moments there as well. But this is the Isaiah 3 nation. We're witnessing it. Isaiah 3 and verse 1 says, "For behold, the Lord of hosts, does take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water." If you're not familiar with this, you can request a copy of the United States and Britain in Prophecy to explain that this is about our nations. This is about the United States of America. It's about the United Kingdom. Verse 2 says, "The mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet and the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50 and the honorable man and the counselor and the cunning artificer and the eloquent orator, I will give children to be their princes and babes shall rule over them." We don't have the eloquent orator anymore. We don't have the honorable men leading. Now, these men, God is using them to accomplish his purpose for a while. But look at the curses besetting this nation. And these men who are being used, they don't have long-term solutions. You can see that in that debate. Verse 12 says, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the way of thy paths." Watching that debate, I didn't watch the whole thing, but I did listen to the full response from both of them when they were asked about childcare. And of course, the moderators, they weren't going to ask about much about immigration or about rising crime, but they asked about childcare. And well, it's so expensive to put your kids in daycare because dad has to work and mom has to work. Got to have the dual income. And J.D. Vance, you know, all he could talk about was, I'm so proud of my wife because she's a graduate. She's got a great job. And we're raising three kids. But why couldn't he say something like, even just from an economic perspective, why can't the family live off of a single income anymore? That wasn't even that long ago when a family could have a nice house and have a large family off of the father's income. Why not just say, I want to get back to that so that moms don't have to work? But then aside from that, he couldn't say this because it'd be political suicide, but say something like, I would love for my mom or for my wife to be able to be at home to take care of our children, because this is a very important role in society because they're helping raise the future of our country. I don't want to put the kids in daycare for 9 hours a day so that they can be taught by some Marxist-educated childcare professional. He couldn't say something like that. Couldn't. It's too corrective. It's going to push away too many of those swing voters. Where's the hope in really any of the answers given at that debate from either side? Maybe there's a short-term gain from those things, but long-term, what does a society look like where we just let the community, quote-unquote, raise the children? More tax credits so that you don't have to be at home taking care of the kids. This is an article in the Wall Street Journal. It's titled, Americans Are More Reliant Than Ever on Government Aid. It says, Americans' reliance on government support is soaring, driven by programs such as Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I mean, the Republicans know they can't touch this. They can't say anything about Social Security. You can't touch those things. It would be political suicide to do that. But this article is talking about how the Democrat counties that have relied on federal aid, they've been consistent. They haven't grown. They're primarily going to be the big urban centers. But they're pointing out how Republican counties are relying more and more on federal aid, especially rural counties. And so many people are reliant on the federal government to provide for them. I was thinking about that when all of those clips were coming out of Springfield, and the citizens there were complaining that the lines were so long at the welfare offices because all of the Haitians were getting in front of them. And part of me just thought, why are so many Americans reliant on that too? I mean, the citizens should come first, no doubt about it. But we've just got a whole nation now that is built on, well, frankly, the executive is just too big. There's too much federal power. I remember this movie I really enjoyed, and there's a scene where the dad, he can't find work. He hurt his hand, and he finally breaks down, and he goes to get some government assistance. This was in the Great Depression. And he uses that money, and then he finally makes it big. It was called Cinderella Man. And then he finally makes it big, and he takes that money, and he goes and he pays it back. Because it was shameful to have to take that money. You wanted to be able to provide for your own. Now, there's something to be said about getting help. And the community should be able to help out. The federal government's way too involved in that in this country. This is another article from the Wall Street Journal titled, America's Young Men Are Falling Even Further Behind. It says more women ages 25 to 34 have entered the workforce in recent years than ever. Not getting married, not at home with the kids. That's dishonorable. We've got to pursue a career, even though that's like the most fulfilling thing you could do as being a parent, as your full-time job. It says the share of young men in the labor market, meanwhile, hasn't grown in a decade. They have a lot of stories in this article about young men who are just dropping out of college and just staying home with their parents. It quotes one of these professors. It says, social scientists cite shifts away from traditional gender roles and single earner family structures, as well as declines in traditional male-dominated industries such as manufacturing. These men, they don't have a sense of purpose. They're not the breadwinner. They don't have a wife relying on them. They don't have children relying on them. And they're not being pushed. They don't even have that desire to have a family. So there's nothing even motivating them to work harder. Says the sense a lot of young men have is not being sure that they are needed or that they are going to be needed by their families, by their communities, by society. Says Richard Reeves, president of the American Institute for Boys and Men. We have to fulfill the God-given roles. And then you will be happy. There will be more prosperity. But we flip the house upside down, like Isaiah 3 says, the women rule. And they call that progress, even though the results are all right in front of us, screaming at us. Those men don't have a sense of purpose. They're not raised to understand their roles. They're raised thinking, well, we're all equals. And whatever you can do, I can do. Revisionist historians, they hate the impact of men on society. We covered this a lot a few years ago, but just how much they despise the impact that really one man can have on a home, on a state, on a country, on the world. They can't stand the thought of Churchill saving Western civilization by himself. This was around the time that Churchill movie came out. And it was a great movie, but there's the one scene where Churchill's getting ready to give his speech, and they make it seem like he was depressed and he was discouraged and he was waffling, so to speak. And he got all of his inspiration and encouragement by this imaginary train ride that he took, where everyone on the tube, you know, roused him up and got him fired up about it. No, he was the only one. He stood alone. But to say that one man can change the course of history, that doesn't fit their agenda. I was thinking about this article in the recent Trumpet magazine, the one with President Trump shaking his fist on the front. There's an article in there, a really interesting article about El Salvador. And a young man who took on the cartels in his country, a young man who faced a lot of opposition. I'm amazed he wasn't killed, but he had the fortitude to take on a huge crisis in his problem in his 30s. And he became president. And he's cleaning up this country, a single man, one man, changing history, changing the course of history for that nation. That article is titled "How a Philosopher King Transformed El Salvador." It's an awesome article. And I was just amazed thinking about what he was doing in his 20s and 30s and how he survived all that. And at one point, he's talking about how they can't solve the solutions there. He didn't know what to do, so he prayed about it. A really fantastic story. And again, this man's world, and there's a limit to how we can solve these problems, but he's getting back to some fundamentals there that do solve problems. Talking about fundamentals and keeping it simple. God's way is simple. You didn't hear a simple way in that debate on either side. A lot of times I watch those debates and I'm just scratching my head. How do you implement these things? How do you do this? How do you write these laws? And they don't even know. They're 1,200 pages long, and every lawyer gets to insert their own little piece of jargon in there so they ensure that their congressman gets what they want. God's way is very simple. Think about what Jesus Christ did as a young, single man in his early 30s. Mr. Fleury's talked a lot about that in Bible studies on this show from his Life and Teachings of Jesus Christ class. God's solutions are very simple. We need the Creator to rule, and that's what this Day of Trumpets is about, this Feast of Trumpets. Think about a parent and a child. That baby doesn't know anything. The parent has to teach that child and rule that child so that they can be brought up the right way. And it's the same relationship with mankind and their Creator. We don't know how to live. Mankind doesn't know anything apart from the Creator. We need our Creator to teach us, and we have to be humble and take that instruction. Imagine God's solutions being something like, in order to solve that, you're going to have to campaign a little bit more in West Virginia because they're turning into a swing state. And if you win them in the Electoral College, it's a good chance you're going to get the Senate. Then once you've got the Senate, then you're going to be able to pass this bill. Oh, but you've got to remember that you need Congress or the House over here. And well, you're going to have to raise up a super PAC. And you sit through and you hear all of that and you think, is that what God wants? Is that how God plans to rule? God is perfect, and we should want that instruction from Him. This is a quote from the booklet by Mr. Armstrong, "Pagan Holidays or God's holy days, which? He says, this is quoting the verses talking about Trump, but, "And the Lord spoke, saying, in the seventh month, in the first day of the month, shall you have a Sabbath, a memorial, a blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You shall do no servile work therein." That's why we're not working on this day. Mr. Armstrong says, "Here is pictured to us that the next blessed event in God's redemptive plan, when Christ shall come again in clouds with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of God," 1 Thessalonians 4. "It shall be at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall all be changed," 1 Corinthians 15. Mr. Armstrong says, "Unless Christ returns to resurrect the dead, we would never gain eternal life. If there is no resurrection, then they also which are fallen asleep in Christ are perished," reading on in 1 Corinthians 15. Christ is going to return. This day is a great day because it's the ultimate solution to all of these complex world events that you see. Neither of them have solutions. And when they do, they're complicated. That bit where in the debate where Tim Walz was just saying, well, listen to the experts, and then J.D. Vance says, well, where have they gotten us over the last four decades? And experts, they disagree with each other. Well, what's the solution? God is very simple. There is one being who is going to return to this earth and establish God's government. And he is a perfect being and will administer that government perfectly. Christ is not going to return with a committee like the United Nations with some rotating leadership position. There's not, a new Christ every 4 or 5 months. God's way is very simple. Speaking of the United Nations, they've got all of these employees who are part of the Hamas terrorist group. That is not a hope-filled future, the United Nations there. There will be one world government, and it will be established by our perfect Creator. And mankind will have to be humbled so that we can learn like little children. I love reading these verses in Daniel where it talks about this Daniel 2 image that symbolizes the great empires of human history. And it gets to the end of this image, and then this whole image is decimated by this stone. Daniel 2 and verse 34 through 35. You saw till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, and were of iron and clay, and broke them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. All this complex government system that we watch on TV that tries to solve problems, it's not going to exist. All of that stress that it creates, it's just going to be smashed into dust and just blow away in the wind. And there will be righteous rule. Daniel 2 and verse 44, again expounding on those verses. "And in those days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people." No more rule of man over man. "But it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it break in pieces the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter. And the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure." It's going to rule forever. People will mock that. They'll laugh at the Bible. But look at their solutions. Look at their ideas. God laughs at that. God laughs at them. Because we're all so puny. We don't know what we're doing. We need our Creator. We need this Feast of Trumpets. That is all that I have time for on today's show. Thank you very much for listening. Please join us again tomorrow. We'll be live tomorrow with Mr. Stephen Fleury. If you have any comments, for the show, you can send those to td@thetrumpet.com.